You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
It's a combination of a bubble, a Ponzi scheme, and an environmental disaster. That's how one of the world's leading authorities on finance and economics described Bitcoin earlier this year. On this week's episode, we'll explore the world of cryptocurrencies and dig into why they're unlikely to live up to the hype, where cryptocurrencies might actually hold some promise, and how Bitcoin might end up breaking the internet. Welcome to Benchmark. I'm Scott Landman, an economics editor with Bloomberg News in Washington. On this episode, we head across the Atlantic to talk with our guest, who's based in Switzerland at the Bank for International Settlements, which is essentially a central bank for central banks. Hyun-Song Shin is the head of research at the BIS. Previously, he was a professor at Princeton University and the London School of Economics. Dr. Shin, thank you for joining us on Benchmark.
Thank you, Scott. It's good to be on the show.
Now, Hyun, it was actually your boss, Augustine Karstens, the head of the BIS, who made that comment about Bitcoin being a bubble, a Ponzi scheme, and an environmental disaster. You recently had a chapter in the BIS economic report and made a speech on the topic that were a bit less sensational, though still critical of the limits with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Before we get into those issues, let me ask you, why do you think Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies have gotten so much hype and attention and hit a nerve with some people as the next big thing?
I think it's the promise of technology solving one of the basic problems in economics, which is to generate trust in a very decentralized way. And to really address that question, it's worth thinking about what money is. And money is a social institution where I accept money as payment in the expectation that others will accept money. And in that sense, money itself is a worthless token, and that's true whether it's a piece of paper with a face on it or whether it's a digital token. But the fact that others accept the money gives it value. And in that sense, although the tokens are intrinsically worthless, it becomes something of value because of the social conventions that back up the use of money. And I think what's really captured the imagination is that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have come along, which promise money-like acceptability, but without the backing of a central authority, like a central bank.
That's right. And I found that history of money in your chapter very fascinating. And I agree that it is kind of avoiding that use of authority, this anti-authority streak that runs through some veins of our world, that's probably driving that. Let's just talk about the use of Bitcoin for a moment. How does buying something with Bitcoin compare or contrast with a regular online transaction that I might do with a credit card?
Yeah, so I think it's worth looking at some of the basic concepts here. When anthropologists have looked back and looked at early human societies without money, I mean, they conjecture that, you know, goods were provided for the promise of someone to return the favor in the future. And in that sense, money can be seen as a kind of record-keeping device where we keep tabs on who's paid whom and who owes what to whom. And rather than having a tangle of IOUs, money is a kind of summary of the services that you've provided others in the past. and it gives you an entitlement to goods and services with respect to others in the future. Now, the way that cryptocurrencies work, in particular a blockchain-based cryptocurrencies work, is that it's an ecosystem which has the users who make and receive payments, but then you need others to maintain the system. So there are the bookkeepers who record the transactions. And what's very distinctive about Bitcoin and other similar cryptocurrencies is that the register is maintained by broadcasting the transactions to every node in the system. That's to say, there is a network of bookkeepers, and the ledger is updated simultaneously so that every ledger is identical. And in that sense, there is no need for a central authority. So if I were to make a transaction, what would happen is I would record the transaction, make a payment to, let's say, a vendor, and then the bookkeeper who will update the ledger will then broadcast that transaction to every other bookkeeper, and all the ledgers are updated simultaneously. And so when everyone accepts that transaction, that would be a valid transaction within the system.
And that's different from a traditional system, the current system, where it's really a central authority like the central bank that would validate the transaction, correct?
That's right. So under the conventional system, what would happen is that I have a deposit in a bank, and then I make a payment by instructing the bank to make the payment to a vendor. And what the bank would do is then to debit my account and credit the account of the vendor. And in the payment system as a whole, ultimately, what would back up the system is that these transactions are then settled on the central bank's balance sheet.
Now, when you talk about how everybody has to keep this ledger, this gets to the issue of why Bitcoin or why cryptocurrencies can only get so big. You really get to this issue of what you call scalability. What would happen if Bitcoin or cryptocurrency were to become so widely used that it were kind of like a global currency, and it would require tons and tons of computing power just to process each individual transaction? Is that where we get into the environmental disaster part of what Mr. Carson said?
Yes, I think this goes to the ecosystem that I discussed earlier. So there are the users who make and receive payments, but then there are the bookkeepers. And the way that the system works is to use the individual incentives of the bookkeepers so that they have an incentive to maintain the system, and they have an incentive to maintain the system that keeps the records faithful to the intentions of the users. And the way that it works in the case of Bitcoin is that the miners compete to scoop up the transactions that are waiting to be processed. And they compete by solving mathematical puzzles using computing power at their disposal. And the solution of the puzzles do not serve any particular purpose in itself other than to select a miner to update a payment. And the natural question then is, what is in it for the miners? What are the incentives for the miners to engage in this kind of activity? And the answer is, of course, that they receive a reward for engaging in mining and engaging in updating the ledger. And the reward comes in two forms. One is a reward in terms of the Bitcoin itself. So there's a block reward, so-called. But that part is due to be phased out over time. But the other part, which is the crucial part, is that the users pay a voluntary user fee. So they pay a fee so that their transactions are processed. And because it's voluntary, it really depends on how much the system is being used at that time. So if there is a lot of congestion in the system where many users are trying to have their transaction processed, then you're competing with other users who are also paying their fees. So when you have a lot of congestion, you can have episodes when the users have to pay quite a high fee in order for their transaction to be processed. At some point last year, in December, you had to pay in excess of $50 per transaction in order to have your...
For a $2 coffee, as you mentioned in that paper, right?
Exactly. So if you bought a $2 coffee and insisted on paying for it using Bitcoin, you would have had to pay in excess of $50 to have that transaction processed. Now, the natural question there is, why don't you just increase the capacity? Because that is simply a technical issue. But I think this is where the question becomes very interesting, because we need to think about not only the technology, but also the economics. Because the question then is, what's in it for the miner when you increase the capacity? Well, there, because the user fee is voluntary, if you increase the capacity to such an extent that there is no congestion, then the users really have no incentive to pay a voluntary user fee. And then there are no rewards there to be collected by the miners. And the bookkeepers themselves will have no rewards to sustain, you know, their activity. So I think this is a case where the economics really bump into the technology.
How do you get from here to where you say that it could break the internet if it gets too big?
I think that's really about the specific workings of a particular type of cryptocurrency, which is Bitcoin. And there, the idea is that once the transactions accumulate over time, and the value of a system like this is that the whole history of transactions are recorded, and everyone is carrying around the ledger of all the past transactions. And the size of the transactions become larger and larger. And if you imagine lugging around a very large ledger of the history of all transactions that ever occurred, then these files can become larger and larger. And it could become a very big burden on the capacity of the system to actually maintain. But of course, this is particular to a specific cryptocurrency, which is Bitcoin. It's not a general point about cryptocurrencies that may rely on alternative ways of keeping records.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
So let's talk about the other issue, another major issue that you discussed, and that's the finality of the transactions. Can you talk a little bit about this hurdle, that someone might be able to actually go back and maybe erase the transaction you made to falsify the ledger? Isn't that a major weakness of cryptocurrencies?
Yes, and I think this the issue of finality goes back to what a payment system is. So finality is the idea that once you've made a payment, it's final, so that no one can go back and alter the facts to you know, distort history, as it were. And so the technical issue here is that because what is a valid payment depends on what the bookkeepers agree is a valid payment, it is the result of the collective decision of the bookkeepers themselves. And just as there is an interaction between the users, there is also an interaction between the miners. And the way that a blockchain-based cryptocurrency works is that what is the truth depends on what is the current valid chain of the blocks of transactions. And theoretically, it is possible for a group of the bookkeepers to collude and hitch the latest transaction to a block that is further up the chain, rather than follow the rules and hitch the block to the longest chain. And if that happens, the branch that consists of the transactions recorded in the block that comes to a dead end become all void. And so you may have thought that you have bought something and paid for it, but then if it is part of a branch that dies off, it no longer becomes valid. And so if your transaction ends up in one of these dead end chains, your payment, which you thought you had made, turns out not to have been made after all. And so although it's very likely that when your transaction is accepted and hitched to the latest chain that your payment is valid, it's not 100% valid. It's valid with a very high percentage, but not exactly 100%. And once you allow the possibility that a payment may not be final with 100% certainty, what you might come across is a case where you would like to make a payment which is conditional on another payment. So if it's a very large payment, I don't have money in my account at the moment. I am relying on receiving a payment in order to make my own payment. Well, imagine that we have an economy where there is a large network of these very complex payments. If it turns out that some of the payments in the past are declared null and void, then there will be a cascade of payments which were relying on that payment, which become undermined as well. So you could have another twist to what is a fairly familiar problem in systemic risk, where you could have a cascade of defaults, where one payment being declared void will mean that other payments are declared void as well.
Now, it doesn't sound like a very stable system, or at least something with a lot of holes that you're describing, probably why central banks have been fairly downbeat on cryptocurrencies as something that, you know, could actually be used in the world. And the Bank for International Settlements view is, it's partly because as a bank that kind of gathers central bankers together, institution that gathers them together, you often talk about these kinds of regulatory issues. Is there any way that this world can potentially be regulated by any institution? Would you basically have to create a new global regulator out of whole cloth if this were to become something that was more widely used?
I think to some extent, the whole nature of cryptocurrencies is that they were designed to lie outside any particular jurisdiction. But I think the issue of regulation, you know, need not become a big issue unless it affects, you know, other aspects of economic activity. I think what has generated some disquiet is the fact that cryptocurrencies piggyback on the conventional monetary system. I mean, it's really the price in conventional money of cryptocurrencies, which has grabbed all the headlines. And it's the way in which it has taken on some of the appearance of financial assets that has, also generated some concern. So it's the fact that they are intertwined with the conventional monetary system, and they have a price in terms of conventional money, which, you know, gives it another dimension. And I think there is a larger debate about whether cryptocurrencies have taken on more of a character of an asset where people pay to hold them rather than to use them as money. And I think it's the second aspect of this attribute of cryptocurrencies as financial assets, which has, I think, generated a debate about whether they should be regulated, whether consumers should be protected from fraud and market manipulation. And I think this is where the debates on regulation have become, you know, much more acute.
And certainly the price of Bitcoin has been a regular headline on Bloomberg for some years now. Now, aside from how big Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies would get, you know, we hear a lot about blockchain technology that you were discussing, and, you know, how it could potentially be used in ways maybe outside of the cryptocurrency world. Is there promise for blockchain technology by itself? And in addition, are there potential uses for cryptocurrencies on a small scale that might be valid, that might actually help some corners of the financial system?
I think it's definitely the case that the technology itself has many useful applications. The general version of blockchain is what's called distributed ledger technology. And the idea there is that among many dispersed individuals. They can keep a record of the current state of a complex system by updating in real time the ledger of all the transactions, so that everyone can have the same view of where things stand. So this is an idea with many applications. For example, within a single firm, where you have many decision makers within the firm, but you know, they may be separated by distance, and they may be separated by different time zones, but you can always keep track of where things stand, where you stand with respect to the system. And this is just like any other database where, you know, you can update, you know, who's paid whom, where the goods are, where the next input needs to be made, and so on. And the technology itself can be maintained without any particular use as currency. It's just like updating an Excel spreadsheet, but making sure that everyone has exactly the same copy of that spreadsheet. I think where it becomes much more difficult is when the technology takes on this attribute of a financial asset, which then masquerades as a currency, and then you know, gives rise to promises that may not be fully fulfilled, you know, given the some of the underlying flaws of the economics.
Now, to wrap up, in your speech, you conclude that cryptocurrencies, quote, fall a long way short of being able to sustain a monetary system. After all we've discussed here, is there any chance that we're all wrong and we'll wake up one day and it will be central banks who are the relics and Bitcoin that's replaced the dollar as the world's leading currency?
I think the bar for that is quite high. If we think about the way that the monetary system works, it's underpinned by trust. And the promise of cryptocurrencies is that you can deliver that trust in a decentralized way, while at the same time having the scale to accommodate you know, very large transactions by very many people in a flexible way, and something which gives certainty. And it's certainly possible that the technology will advance, that will iron out some of the wrinkles. But one of the things that we tried very hard to do in the special chapter of the annual economic report is to point out that the underlying economics are really quite challenging. And no matter how advanced the technology becomes, the underlying problems in the economics look like you know, quite insurmountable problems.
Okay. Hyun-Song Shin, head of research at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. Thank you very much for being with us on Benchmark.
Thank you, Scott.
Benchmark will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, our Bloomberg app, as well as podcast destinations such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Scott Landman. And our guest is at HYUNSONGSHIN. Benchmark is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.